Chapter 12. Zoe. Zoe stood at the bottom of the stairs outside the heavy oak door of the meditation room, bent double, her hands on her thighs, trying to catch her breath. Lately, she'd been having the occasional mini panic attack. Not proper panic attacks, which she understood to be awful and had people calling for ambulances. Just these mini episodes where suddenly, out of nowhere, she felt like she'd spiked her heart rate in a spin class. It was fine to be puffing and panting when she was doing a spin class, but not when she was sitting cross-legged on the floor doing nothing except listening to a mad woman talk about death. She wondered if this was how it was for Zach. He used to say that asthma felt like someone had placed 10 bricks on his chest. Zoe put a hand to her chest. No bricks. It wasn't asthma. Just run-of-the-mill panic. She could always trace back the causes. This time it was hearing Marsha's mad thoughts on the wonderfulness of her near-death experience. It had made Zoe remember the poem her Uncle Alessandro had read at her brother's funeral. Death is nothing at all. Zoe had started thinking about how much she hated that poem because it was all lies. Her brother had not just gone into another room. He was gone. So gone. So silent. Not a text, not a post, not a tweet, not a word. And the next thing, she was struggling for breath, and all she could think was, get out. She felt bad about breaking the noble silence, especially after her dad's sneezing had created havoc in the room. The people at this retreat had no idea that those were her dad's most subdued sneezes. One of his students had once made a 3-minute film called Mr. Marconi Sneezes, which was just a montage of her dad sneezing at different times with a soundtrack. It had gone a bit viral. "Did someone go through our bags?" said a man's voice from behind the door. She'd put money on it being the seedy-looking guy, who was nearly as tall as her dad and twice as wide. Zoe couldn't hear the response. She climbed the narrow stone staircase and shoved hard to open the second heavy door that led back into the main part of the house. She couldn't disappear for too long because her parents would worry, which wasn't at all suffocating. Ever since Zach died, it was as if Zoe's life was in permanent jeopardy, and only her parents' secret, ongoing vigilance would save her. Her mum and dad truly believed that if Zoe didn't get the flu shot, if her car brakes weren't checked every 6 months, if she didn't have a plan for getting home, she would die. It was as simple as that. And when they so casually asked a question like, "Are you getting an Uber?" their faces averted, their hands busy doing something else, they couldn't disguise the dread beneath their words. And so she didn't brush them off. She didn't walk away when her mother stood next to her and tried to secretly listen to her breathing, even though, unlike Zach, who'd had asthma from when he was a child, Zoe had never had asthma in her life. She clamped down hard on her irritation and let them listen to her breathe and gave the answers and constant reassurance they needed. She wouldn't disappear on them now. She'd just take 10 minutes for herself and then she'd sneak back in and hopefully Mad Marsha would have got everyone under control by then and they'd all be silently meditating. There were no staff about as she wandered into the lavender room. It was lavishly lavender. There were multiple tall vases stuffed with sprigs of lavender, The soft furnishings and cushions were all in various shades of lavender, and just in case you'd missed the point, pictures of lavender adorned the lavender-coloured walls. Zoe went over to the window, which looked straight out onto the rose garden, a rectangle of lush green grass bordered by high hedges, with garden beds of abundant white roses. This was where they would do Tai Chi at dawn tomorrow morning. This place was all very nice, if dull, but it was kind of shocking if they really had searched the bags. Luckily, Zoe had taken precautions, just in case. She knew how to get alcohol into alcohol-free parties. She'd wrapped up her contraband like a present, using bubble wrap to disguise the wine bottle shape, complete with a gift tag that said, "Happy Anniversary, Mum and Dad." She'd checked when she got to the room, and the present was untouched in her bag. On Zach's 21st birthday, Zoe was going to toast him at midnight with a glass of wine. When she and Zach were born, the maths teacher at her dad's school had given them each a bottle of Grange. Strange presents for babies. The bottles were probably meant to be in a temperature-controlled cellar, but Zoe's family weren't big on alcohol. The wine had been sitting in the back of the linen cupboard, behind the bath towels, all these years, waiting for their 21st birthday. According to the internet, this particular vintage had a beautiful limp aspect with a mélange of dried fruits and spices and a long, imperious finish. Zach would have found that description funny. A long, imperious finish. Her eyes followed the softly curved silhouette of the blue-green hills along the horizon, and she thought of her ex-boyfriend, and how hard he'd tried to convince her to join him on a surfing trip to Bali with a group of friends. He couldn't believe it when she insisted it was impossible. "I have to be with my parents," she'd told him. "Any other time, just not January." In the end, he got angry, and then all of a sudden they were taking a break, and next thing, they were broken up. She'd kind of thought she had loved him. She banged her forehead gently against the glass of the window. Did he think she wanted to be here with her parents? Did he think she wouldn't prefer to be in Bali? Last January had been terrible, like her parents were burning to death from the inside, their internal organs liquefied while they pretended that everything was just fine. "Hello there. It's Zoe, isn't it? We met earlier. I'm Francis." Zoe turned from the window. It was the strawberry blonde lady with the bright red lipstick whom her dad had accosted on the stairs. She was adjusting an old-fashioned giant tortoiseshell clip in her hair, and she looked flushed in the face. "Hi," said Zoe. "I know we're not meant to be speaking, but I feel like this has turned out to be an unplanned interlude in Marsha's noble silence." "What's going on down there?"
"It's all got very awkward," said Francis. She sat down on one of the lavender couches. "Oh, dear, this is one of those swallow-you-up couches."
She shoved two cushions behind her back. "Ow! My back! Ow!" She wriggled about. "No, I'm okay. That's better. Well, you know the man, the grumpy-looking one with the hacking cough? Not that I can talk. Don't come too close to me. I don't want to infect you. Although I feel like my germs are nicer than his germs. Anyway, he's getting very worked up because apparently he smuggled in a whole minibar, by the sound of it.
And, well, this is embarrassing, but they took some things from my bag too, and I kind of felt like I should have been supporting the grumpy man. You know, like, that is a breach of privacy. You can't do that. We have rights. She punched a fist in the air. Zoe sat on the couch opposite her and smiled at the fist punch. But I got embarrassed because I didn't want everyone to know I also brought in contraband that was confiscated. And I know this isn't an episode of Survivor, but I didn't want to form an alliance with that man because he seems so, well, so I said I needed some air too, which I feel like was one of the bravest things I've ever done. I brought in contraband too, said Zoe. Did you? Frances brightened. Did they find it? No. If they searched my bag, they missed it. I wrapped it up like a present for my parents.
That's genius. What is it?
It's a bottle of wine, said Zoe. Really expensive wine. Oh, and a bag of Reese's peanut butter cups. I'm addicted.
Yum.
Frances sighed. Congratulations. I like your ingenuity. Thank you, said Zoe. Frances picked up a cushion and hugged it. I'm perfectly capable of going for 10 days without a glass of wine. I just, well, I don't know. I was being wicked.
I don't even like wine, said Zoe.
Oh, did you just want to prove you could beat the system? I brought the wine to toast my brother's 21st birthday. It's in a few days. He died 3 years ago. She saw Frances's inevitably stricken face. It's okay, she told her quickly. We weren't close. People usually looked relieved when she told them that, but Frances's face didn't change at all. I'm so sorry, she said. It's fine. Like I said, we really didn't get on. Zoe tried to clarify it for her. Don't stress. You're off the hook. She remembered her friend, Kara, the day after Zach's funeral, saying, "At least you weren't close." Kara was really close to her sister. "What was your brother's name?" asked Frances, as if this was somehow important. "Zach," said Zoe, and the name sounded odd and painful in her mouth. She heard a roaring sound in her ears and felt for a moment as if she might faint. Zoe and Zach. We were twins. Very cutesy names.
I think they're lovely names, said Frances. But if you're twins, that means it's your birthday in a few days too.
Zoe took a sprig of lavender out of a vase and began to shred it. Technically, but I don't celebrate on that day anymore. I kind of changed my birthday. She'd officially moved her birthday to the 18th of March. It was a nicer date, a cooler, less tempestuous time of year. The 18th of March was Grandma Maria's birthday, and Grandma Maria used to say it had never once rained on her birthday, and maybe that was true. Everyone said they should check the weather records in case it was some sort of phenomenon only Grandma Maria had noticed. But nobody ever got around to it. Grandma Maria had always said she'd live to 100, like her own mother. But she died 1 month after Zach of a broken heart. Even the doctor said it was a broken heart. Zach died the day before our 18th birthday, said Zoe. We were meant to be having a Zed party. I was going as Zoe, which seemed really funny at the time.
Oh, Zoe,
Frances leaned forward. Zoe could tell she wanted to touch her, but was stopping herself.
"So that's why I changed it," said Zoe. "It's like not fair to Mum and Dad to have to celebrate my birthday the day after when they're still totally wrecked from the anniversary. January is really hard for my parents."
"Of course it would be," said Frances. Her eyes were bright with sympathy.
"Hard for all of you, I imagine.
So you thought it would be good to get away?"
"We just wanted somewhere quiet, and a health resort seemed like a good idea because we're all really unhealthy."
"Are you? You don't look at all unhealthy to me."
"Well, for a start, I have way too much sugar in my diet," said Zoe.
"Sugar is the new villain," said Frances. "It used to be fat. Then it was carbs. It's hard to keep up."
"No, but sugar is seriously bad," said Zoe. "It wasn't hard to keep up at all. Everyone knew sugar was terrible for you. They've done all this research. I need to withdraw from my sugar addiction."
"Hmm," said Frances.
"I eat too much chocolate, and I'm addicted to Diet Coke. That's why my skin is so bad."
Zoe put a fingertip to a blind pimple near her lip. She couldn't stop touching it.
"Your skin is gorgeous." Frances gesticulated wildly, probably because she was trying not to look at Zoe's pimple.
Zoe sighed. "People should be honest.
My parents are exercise fanatics, but my dad has a junk food addiction, and Mum basically has an eating disorder."
She reflected. Her mother would not like any aspect of this conversation.
"Please don't tell her I said that. She doesn't really have an eating disorder. She's just kind of weird about food."
Even before Zach died, Zoe's mother had been like that. She couldn't bear to see lavish displays of food, which was a problem, seeing as she'd married a man with a big extended Italian family. Heather suffered from heartburn and stomach cramps and other digestive issues she referred to only obliquely. She never saw food as just food. She always had some fierce emotional response to it. She was starving or bloated or craving something specific and unattainable.
"Anyway, what about you?" she asked Frances. She wanted to shift the focus. She'd revealed far too much about herself and her family to this stranger. "Why did you decide to do this?"
"Oh, you know, I'm run down, I've done something to my back, I have a cold I can't seem to shake. I suppose I could do with losing a few kilos. Just the normal middle-aged stuff."
"How old are your kids?" asked Zoe.
Frances smiled. "No kids."
"Oh!"
Zoe was taken aback, worried that she might have made some kind of sexist faux pas.
"Sorry."
"Don't be sorry," Frances said. "It was my choice not to have children. I just never saw myself as a mother. Ever. Even when I was a kid."
"But you're so motherly," thought Zoe.
"No husband either," said Frances. "Just two ex-husbands. No boyfriend. I'm very single." It was cute, the way she said boyfriend.
"I'm very single too," said Zoe. And Frances smiled, as if Zoe had said something cute.
"I thought I was in love with someone recently, but he wasn't who he said he was," said Frances. "It turned out to be an internet romance scam." She made quote marks with her fingers.
"Oh, my God,"
thought Zoe. How stupid would you have to be? What do you do for a living? She changed the subject because she was literally going bright red with embarrassment for the woman. I write romance novels, said Frances. Or I did. I might be in need of a career change. Romance novels, repeated Zoe. It was getting worse. She tried to keep her face neutral. Please, God, don't let it be erotica. Are you a reader? Asked Frances. Sometimes, said Zoe. Never, ever romance. What made you become a romance writer? Well, when I was about 15, I read Jane Eyre, and it was a strange, sad time in my life. My dad had just died, and I was hormonal and grieving and just very impressionable. And when I got to that famous line, you know the one, reader, I married him, it just had this profound effect on me. I'd sit in the bath and murmur to myself, reader, I married him. And then I'd just sob. It had remarkable staying power. Reader, I married. Oh! She demonstrated herself sobbing dramatically like a teenage girl, hand to her forehead. Zoe laughed. Frances said, you've read Jane Eyre, right? I think I saw the movie once, said Zoe. Ah, well, said Frances sympathetically. Anyway, I know that reader I married him line has become virtually a cliche now it's referenced so often. Reader, I divorced him. Reader, I murdered him. But for me, at that time of my life, it was, well, profound. I remember being amazed that four words could affect me in that way. So I guess I just developed an interest in the power of words. The first romance story I ever wrote was heavily influenced by Charlotte Bronte, except without the mad woman in the attic. My leading man was a heady mix of Mr. Rochester and Rob Lowe. Rob Lowe, said Zoe. I had his poster on my wall, said Frances. I can still taste his lips. Very smooth and papery. Matte gloss. Zoe giggled. I felt the same way about Justin Bieber. There might even be one of my books here, said Frances. There often is in places like this. She scanned the shelves of paperbacks, then smiled, a hint of pride. Bingo! She stood up, clutching her back, went to one of the shelves and squatted down to pull out a battered-looking, chunky paperback. There you go. She handed it to Zoe and sat back down on the couch with a grunt. Awesome, said Zoe. The book looked terrible. It was called Nathaniel's Kiss, and the picture on the front showed a girl with long, curly, fair hair staring wistfully out to sea. At least it didn't look erotic. Anyway, my last book got rejected, said Frances, so I might be looking for a new career soon. Oh, said Zoe. I'm sorry. Well, said Frances, and she shrugged, gave her a half smile, her palm up, and Zoe knew what she was trying to say. Zoe's friend Erin thought she wasn't allowed to complain about her life anymore without first prefacing it, I know this is nothing compared to what you've been through, with this solemn, wide-eyed look, and Zoe always said, Erin, it's been 3 years. You're allowed to complain about your life. And then she nodded along sympathetically while thinking, you're right. Your car needing 3 new tires is nothing to complain about. I guess I should go back downstairs, said Zoe. My parents get paranoid if they can't pinpoint my location. I think they'd like to put a tracking device on me. Frances sighed.
I guess I should too.
But she didn't move. She gave Zoe a quizzical look. Do you think we're all going to be transformed by the end of this thing? Not really, said Zoe. What do you think?
I don't know, said Frances. I feel like Marcia could do anything. She scares the life out of me.
Zoe laughed, and then they both started as a gong began to sound, over and over, in rapid succession, like an alarm. They jumped to their feet, and Frances grabbed Zoe's arm.
Oh, God, it's just like boarding school. Do you think we're in trouble? Or maybe there's a fire, and we're all evacuating?
I think it probably just means the silence is starting again.
Yes, you're right. Okay, we'll go back together. I'll go first. I'm older. I'm not scared of her.
Yes, you are.
I know. I am. Terrified. Quick, let's go. I'll see you on the other side of the silence.
I'll read your book. Zoe held up the paperback as they left the lavender room and headed back downstairs. It was a crazy thing to say. She had no interest in reading a romance book. But whatever. She liked Frances.
You're not meant to read in the silence.
I'm a rebel, said Zoe. She shoved the book under her top and into the waist of her bike pants. I'll be in an alliance with you. She was just making a weak joke in reference to Frances's comment earlier about Survivor, but Frances stopped in her tracks and turned around with a radiant smile.
Oh, Zoe, I would love to be in alliance with you.
And all of a sudden, it felt like they were. Chapter 13. Marcia.
Two guests, Zoe Marconi and Frances Welty, had excused themselves from the meditation room and not yet come back. The silence had been broken, and one guest, Tony Hogburn, was now demanding his money back and threatening to report Tranquillum House to the Department of Consumer Affairs, blah, blah, blah. Marcia had heard it all before, while the remaining guests looked on with curiosity or concern. Marcia saw poor Yao shoot her an anxious look. He was a warrior. There was no need for stress. She could handle the childlike tantrums of one unhappy, unhealthy man. Solving unexpected problems energized her. It was one of her strengths.
I am very happy to give you a full refund. She fixed Tony with her eyes like a pin through a butterfly. You are free to pack your bags and leave immediately. May I suggest you drive yourself to the nearest village, where you will find a fine pub called the Lion's Heart. Their menu includes something called a Mega Monster Burger with unlimited fries and soft drink. Does that sound delicious?
Sure does, said Tony truculently. And yet he didn't get to his feet.
Oh, my sweetie pie, you need me. You know you need me. You don't want to be you anymore. Of course you don't. Who would?
He tried to wriggle free of her gaze, but she wouldn't let him.
I understand that you are not happy that we searched your bags, but the terms and conditions of your wellness contract clearly state that we have the right to search luggage and confiscate all contraband.
Seriously? Did anyone read that?
Tony looked around the room. Napoleon raised his hand. His wife, Heather, lifted her eyes to the ceiling.
Must have been buried in the fine print, said Tony.
His face had turned mottled red, the color of uncooked steak.
Growth can be painful, Masha told him, her voice gentle. He was a child, an enormous, sulky child. There will be parts of this experience that may be uncomfortable or unpleasant at times, but it's only 10 days. The average person lives around 27,000 days.
Tony's outburst was actually a serendipitous opportunity to shape all their expectations and mold their future behavior. She spoke as if only to him, but the message was for them all.
You are free to leave at any time, Tony. You are not a prisoner. This is a health resort, not a jail.
A few people chuckled.
And you are not a child. You can drink what you want to drink, eat what you want to eat. But there is a reason why you came here, and if you choose to stay, I ask you to commit fully to your journey and to put your trust in me and the other staff at Tranquillum House.
Yeah, fine. I obviously didn't read the fine print properly.
Tony scratched hard at the side of his unshaved face and tugged at the fabric of his dreadful, hot, heavy blue jeans.
I just didn't appreciate my bags being searched.
The aggression was draining from his voice. Now he sounded embarrassed. His eyes peered out at her from within the prison of his poor, tortured body, from which he so desperately needed rescue.
She'd won. She had him. He would be beautiful when she finished with him. They would all be beautiful.
Are there any more areas of concern before we resume the silence?
Ben raised his hand.
Masha observed his wife flash him a look of horror and move slightly away.
Yeah, I have just one question. Are the cars parked undercover?
She looked at him for a moment, long enough to help him see the sadness of this deep attachment to his earthly possessions.
He shifted uncomfortably. They are parked undercover, Ben. Please don't worry. They are perfectly safe.
Okay, but, where are the cars? I've walked around the property and I just can't see where.
As he spoke, he removed his cap and briskly rubbed the top of his head.
For the briefest of moments, Masha saw another boy wearing a baseball cap walking towards her. So strange, and yet so familiar. She felt the love rise within her chest, and she crossed her arms so she could secretly pinch the flesh on her arm, hard enough to hurt, until the vision vanished, and all that was left was here and now,
and the important tasks that lay ahead. As I said, Ben, everyone's cars are perfectly safe. He opened his mouth to speak yet again, and his wife hissed something inaudible through her teeth. He closed his mouth. So, if everyone is in agreement, I would like to recommence the noble silence and begin our guided meditation. Yao, perhaps you could ring the gong to let our missing guests know we would appreciate their return. Yao struck the gong with a mallet, perhaps a little more forcefully than Masha would have done, and within only a few moments, Francis and Zoe had returned, their faces apologetic and guilty. It was clear to Masha that they had been chatting, forming a friendship, perhaps, which would need to be monitored. The point of the silence was to prevent this. She smiled benignly at them as they returned to their mats. Zoe's parents sagged with relief. "Although I will be your guide today," she said, "meditation is a personal experience. Please release your expectations and open yourself to all possibilities. This is called a guided sitting meditation, but that doesn't mean you must sit. Please find the most natural, relaxed position for you. Some of you may like to sit cross-legged. Some of you may like to sit on a chair with your feet flat on the floor. Some of you may prefer to lie down. There are no hard and fast rules here." She watched as they chose their positions with self-conscious faces. Frances lay flat on her back. Tony went and sat on a chair, as did Napoleon. The rest remained cross-legged on their mat. Masha waited until they were all settled. "Let your eyes drift closed." She could sense their fluttering spirits, their anxieties, hopes, dreams, and fears. She was so good at this. It was a pleasure to excel. Interviewers would one day ask, "Were you nervous when you first introduced the new protocol?" Masha would answer, "Not at all. We'd done our research. We knew from the beginning it would be a success." It might be better to admit to a little nervousness. People in this country admired humility. The biggest compliment you could give a successful woman was to describe her as humble. She looked at her 9 guests, all of whom now had their eyes obediently closed as they awaited her instructions. Their destinies were in her hands. She was going to change them, not just temporarily, but forever. "We will begin." Chapter 14. Francis. It was the end of her first day at Tranquillum House, and Francis lay in bed, willfully reading while she drank her evening smoothie. No one could be expected to give up wine and books at the same time. None of the 4 novels she'd packed to get her through the next 10 days had been confiscated, unlike her wine and chocolate, presumably because books weren't on the contraband list. She would never have come here if so. But a small slip of paper had been placed inside the front cover of each of them. "A gentle reminder that we recommend no reading during the noble silence." What an absolute joke.
She didn't know how to go to sleep without reading. It wasn't possible. The book she was reading now was a debut novel that had received rave reviews. There was a lot of buzz about it. It was described as powerful, muscular, and it was written by a man Frances had met at a party last year. The man had been pleasant, shy and bespectacled, not especially muscular, so Frances was trying to forgive him for his lavish descriptions of beautiful corpses. How many more beautiful young women had to die before they could get on with the job of tracking down their murderer? Frances made little tch sounds of disgust. Now the craggy detective was drunk on single malt whiskey in a smoke-hazed bar, and a long-legged girl half his age was whispering into his ear, without inverted commas, this being powerful literary fiction, "I want to fuck you so bad." Frances, who had reached her limit, threw the book across the room. "In your dreams, buddy." She lay back with her hands clasped across her chest and reminded herself that her own debut novel featured a piano-playing, poetry-reciting firefighter. It was cute that the bespectacled author imagined 20-something girls ever whispered, "I want to fuck you so bad," into the ears of 50-something men. She would give the author a consoling little pat on the shoulder next time she saw him at a festival. Anyway, what did she know? Maybe 20-something girls did that all the time. She would ask Zoe. She certainly would not ask Zoe. She reached for her phone on the bedside table to check the news and the weather for tomorrow. No phone. Of course. Well, fine. The bed was a luxurious one, a good mattress, the sheets crisp with a high thread count. Her back hurt, but maybe a little less, thanks to Jan's giant hands. She attempted to quieten her monkey brain as per the rules. In fact, her mind felt stuffed with new faces and new experiences. The long drive here, screaming on the side of the road, the serial killer on vacation. It was that damned book's fault for making her think of serial killers. Ben and Jessica in that car. Yao unexpectedly filling a test tube with her blood. Marcia and her near-death experience. Chatty Napoleon and his intense wife. Lovely young Zoe with her multiple piercings and long, smooth brown legs sitting in the lavender room telling Frances about her dead brother. That's why Zoe's mother had looked so sad on the stairs. She probably wasn't intense at all. Just sad. The tall, dark and handsome man who'd cried Gesundheit, and the flustered lady with Frances's glasses. A lot for one day. Stimulating and distracting. She hadn't had time for any more existential crises, so that was something. She hadn't even thought much about Paul Drabble, apart from when she was telling Jan and Zoe about what had happened. She'd be over her internet scam by the time she left. Over the review. Over everything. And thin. She'd be so thin. Her stomach rumbled. She was starving. Dinner tonight had been possibly the most excruciating meal of her life. When she took her place at the long dining room table, she picked up a small card propped in front of her plate. "At Tranquillum House, we recommend mindful eating. Please take small bites of your food. After each mouthful, place your cutlery back on the table, close your eyes, and chew for at least 14 seconds. Slowly and pleasurably." Oh, God, she thought. We're going to be here forever. She put down the card and looked up to share a can-you-believe-this glance with someone. The only ones prepared to meet her eyes were the astonishingly handsome man, who possibly winked at her, and Zoe, who definitely grinned and responded with a look that said, I know, I can't believe it either. Marcia wasn't in the dining room, but her presence was felt, like that of a managing director or school teacher who could turn up at any moment. Yao and Delilah were there, but they didn't sit down to eat with the guests. Instead, they stood at the side of the room, at either side of a large candelabrum on an ornate sideboard. The lighting in the room was muted, and the candelabrum had three lit candles. They sat in silence for at least 10 endless minutes before the meals came out, delivered by a briskly smiling grey-haired lady in a chef's hat. She didn't say a word, but nevertheless exuded goodwill. It felt so rude not to thank her. Frances tried to convey warm gratitude with a nod of her head. Every person at the table received a different meal. Both Heather and Zoe, who sat next to Frances, received delicious-looking steaks together with baked potatoes. Frances's meal was a quinoa salad. It was excellent, but in Frances's world, she'd call that a side. And by the time she'd masticated each mouthful for 14 seconds, it had lost all flavour. Napoleon, who sat opposite Frances, received some sort of lentil dish. He leaned forward towards the bowl and waved the rising steam towards his nose, enjoying the scent. It was clear the poor man was desperate to chat. Frances would bet that in normal circumstances he would have been discussing the history of the lentil. The serial killer studied his giant bowl of green salad mournfully before picking up his cutlery and stabbing three cherry tomatoes onto his fork with an air of tragic resignation. The flustered lady with the quirky glasses received fish, to her apparent delight. The astonishingly handsome man was assigned chicken and vegetables, which he appeared to find mildly amusing. Ben received a vegetable curry and finished his meal well before the rest of the table. Jessica was given a really delicious-looking stir-fry, which was the wrong dish for the poor girl. She spent ages laboriously twirling the long noodles around her fork and then dabbing worriedly at her face with her napkin for splashes of food. Nobody broke the silence or made eye contact. When Napoleon sneezed again, nobody responded in any way. How quickly people adapted to strange rules and regulations. Heather ate less than half her steak before putting down her knife and fork with a little puff of irritation. Frances had to restrain herself from leaping on it like a wolf. Throughout the meal, Yao and Delilah stood silent and unmoving. They were like footmen, except you couldn't snap your fingers and tell them to let cook know that my lady could do with a larger portion of quinoa and perhaps a medium rare sirloin. The sound of strangers chewing and clinking and scraping their cutlery just about did Frances's head in. Hadn't she once read there was an actual disorder where people suffered real psychological distress at the sound of others eating? There was a name for it. Frances probably had that disorder and had never been diagnosed because you were meant to talk while you dined? Something else to remember to Google once she got her phone back. Eventually, They were done, and they all pulled back their chairs and returned to their rooms. He couldn't even say, "Good night. Sleep well." Now, as Frances drank the last of her smoothie, she thought about the number of silent, insufficient meals ahead of her and considered leaving in the morning. "No one leaves early, Frances," Yao had said today. Well, Frances could be the first. Set a new precedent. She thought of her massage therapist's whispered warning just before the silence began. "Don't do anything you're not comfortable with." What did she mean by that? Frances would certainly not do anything she didn't feel comfortable with. She recalled what Ellen had said when she suggested this place. "Their approach is really quite unconventional." Ellen was her friend. She wouldn't send her somewhere dangerous, would she? Just to lose 3 kilos. You'd want to lose a lot more than 3 kilos if they were doing something dangerous. What could it be? Walking across burning coals for enlightenment? Frances would absolutely not do that. She didn't even like walking across hot sand at the beach. Ellen would have told her if there was walking across hot coals. Ellen was a dear friend. "I've never trusted that, Ellen," Gillian once said, darkly and knowledgeably. But Gillian was always making dark, knowledgeable comments about people, as if everyone had secret mafia connections that only Gillian knew about. Frances missed her greatly. A wave of exhaustion hit her, not surprising after that long drive. She switched off her bedside lamp and fell instantly sound asleep, flat on her back, like a sunbaker. A light shone in her face. Frances woke with a gasp. Chapter 15. Lars.
"What the actual fuck?"
Lars sat up, his heart hammering. A figure stood at the end of his bed, shining a small torch in his face, like a nurse doing hospital rounds. He switched on his bedside lamp. His wellness consultant, the delectable Delilah, stood next to his bed holding up the Tranquillum House dressing gown with one hand. She didn't speak. She lifted one finger and beckoned, as if he would just obediently and silently follow her instructions. "I'm not going anywhere, sweetheart," he said. "It's the middle of the night and I like my sleep." Delilah said, "It's the starlight meditation. It's always on the first night. You don't want to miss it." Lars lay back in bed and shielded his eyes. "I do want to miss it." "You'll like it. It's really beautiful." Lars removed his hand from his eyes. "Did you even knock before you came into my room without permission?"
"Naturally, I knocked," said Delilah. She held up the dressing gown.
"Please. I'll lose my job if you don't come down for it."
"You will not."
"I might. Marcia wants all the guests there for it. It only takes half an hour." Lars sighed. He could refuse on principle, but it was such a first-world privileged principle, he couldn't be bothered. He was awake now, anyway. He sat up and held out his hand for his dressing gown. He slept naked. He could have just leapt from the bed in all his glory to make the point that this was what happened when you woke your sleeping guests in the middle of the night. But he was too well-mannered.
Delilah averted her eyes as he threw back the sheet, although he didn't miss the quick downward flick. She was only human.
"Don't forget the silence," she said, as she stepped into the corridor. "How could I forget the beautiful, noble silence?" said Lars.
She put her finger to her lips. It was a clear night. The stars were out in force, and a full moon illuminated the garden with silvery light. The balmy air was a soft caress against his skin after the hot day. It was, he had to admit, all very pleasant. 9 yoga mats had been placed in a circle, and guests wearing the Tranquillum House dressing gowns lay with their heads facing the center of the circle, where their striking leader, Marcia, sat cross-legged on the grass. Lars saw there was only one empty mat. He was the last guest to arrive. He wondered if he'd made the most fuss about being dragged from his bed. He never ceased to be amazed by the obedience of people at these places. They allowed themselves to be dipped in mud, wrapped in plastic, starved and deprived, pricked and prodded, all in the name of transformation. Of course, Lars did too, but he was prepared to draw the line when necessary. For example, he drew the line at enemas. Also, he did not want to ever, ever discuss his bowel movements. Delilah led Lars to a mat in between the lady who got the giggles when Lars said Gesundheit earlier and the giant lump of a man who had complained about his contraband being confiscated. There was something familiar about the big guy with the contraband. It had been hard not to stare at him through dinner. Lars couldn't shake the irritating feeling that he knew him from somewhere, but he couldn't work out where. Was he one of the husbands? If he was one of the husbands, would he recognize Lars and come after him, like that time he was boarding a plane and a guy in the economy line saw Lars and went nuts? He'd shouted, "You! You're the reason I'm flying cattle class!" Lars had taken extra pleasure in his Perrier Jouet on that flight and walked briskly off the plane towards the priority queue at customs. The big guy didn't look like one of the husbands, but Lars knew he knew him from somewhere. He wasn't good with faces. Ray was great with them. Every time they started a new series, Lars would sit up on the couch, point at the screen and say, "Her! We know her! How do we know her?" Ray normally had it within seconds. Breaking Bad. The girlfriend. Walt let her die. Now shut up. It was a real skill. On the rare occasions that Lars worked it out before Ray, he got very excited and demanded high fives. Lars lay down on the mat between the big guy and the giggling lady. She reminded Lars of one of Renoir's women. Small-faced and round-eyed, with curly hair piled on top of her head. Creamy-skinned, plump and bosomy. Possibly a little vacuous, but he thought they would probably get on. She looked like a fellow hedonist. "Namaste," said Marcia. "Thank you for leaving your beds for tonight's starlight meditation. I am grateful to you for your flexibility, for opening your hearts and minds to new experiences. I am proud of you." She was proud of them. How condescending. She didn't even know them. They were her clients. They were paying for this. And yet,
Lars felt a sense of satisfaction in the garden, as if everyone wanted Marcia to be proud of them.
The retreat you are about to undertake combines ancient Eastern healing wisdom and herbal treatments with the latest cutting-edge advances in Western medicine. I want you to know that although I am not a practicing Buddhist, I have incorporated certain Buddhist philosophies into our practices here.
Yeah, yeah. East meets West. Never heard that before, thought Lars.
This won't take very long. I'm not going to say much. The stars will do the talking for me.
Isn't it funny how we forget to look up at the stars? We scurry about like ants in our day-to-day lives, and look, just look, what's up above our heads. All your life you look down. It's time to look up, to see the stars.
Lars looked at the sky, emblazoned with stars. The big guy on his left gave a chesty cough. So did the busty blonde on his right. Jesus, he should be wearing some sort of sanitation mask. If he came back from this thing with a cold, he wouldn't be happy.
Marcia said, "Some of you may have heard of the word koan. A koan is a paradox or puzzle that Zen Buddhists use during meditation to help them on their quest towards enlightenment. The most famous one is this. What is the sound of one hand clapping?"
Oh, Lord. The website had given the impression that this place leaned more towards luxury wellness.
Lars had a daily yoga and meditation practice, but he preferred his health retreats to avoid too much embarrassing cultural appropriation.
"While you look at the stars tonight, I want you to reflect on two koans. The first one is this. Out of nowhere, the mind comes forth."
Marcia paused. "And the second?
Show me your original face, the one you had before your parents were born."
Lars heard the big guy next to him make a wheezy exhalation that caused him to start rolling about coughing.
"Do not struggle to find answers or solutions," said Marcia.
"This is not a quiz, my people."
She chuckled a little. The woman really was quite a strange mix of charismatic leader and enthusiastic nerd. One moment a guru, the next the newly appointed CEO of a telecommunications company.
"There is no right or wrong answer. Simply look at the stars and reflect without straining for a solution. Just breathe. That's all you need to do. Breathe and watch the stars."
Lars breathed and watched the stars. He did not think of either of the koans. He thought of Ray, and how, early on in their relationship, Ray had convinced him to go camping with him. Never again. They had lain together on a beach, holding hands and looking at the stars, and it had been beautiful. But something had built up and up in Lars's chest until he couldn't take it anymore, and he'd jumped up and run into the ocean, whooping and tearing off his clothes, pretending he was the type of guy who whooped, the type of guy who didn't think about sharks or the temperature of the ocean in October. He smiled a bit, because he knew he couldn't get away with that now. Ray knew about his shark phobia. Ray had asked if he could join him on this retreat. Lars couldn't work out his motivation. He'd never wanted to come to one before. Lars did a couple of retreats a year, but Ray always said they sounded hellish. Why did he suddenly want to come along on this one? Lars thought of Ray's face when he said he'd rather go alone. There was a micro moment when it looked like Lars had slapped him. But then Ray shrugged, smiled, and said that was fine. He was going to eat lasagna every night while Lars was gone and watch nothing but sports on TV. Ray's lifestyle was already squeaky clean and incorporated vegetable juices and smoothies and protein shakes. It wasn't necessary for him to come along to this. Lars needed his time alone. Did he want Lars to feel like shit? Was it somehow related to the text Ray's sister Sarah had sent earlier today? Can you at least think about it? She must have sent it without Ray's knowledge. Lars was sure Ray had accepted that his decision about children was final. It wasn't like he hadn't been upfront about his lack of interest in having a family. He had never said otherwise. "Did I ever say otherwise?" he'd said to Ray, and he'd come close to raising his voice, which was not something he could countenance. He could not be in a relationship with the crassness and indignity of raised voices. It made him shudder to think of it. Ray knew this. "You never said otherwise." Ray had responded evenly, and he didn't raise his voice. "You never misled me. I'm not saying that. I guess I just hoped you might change your mind." Sarah, all shiny-eyed and sincere, had offered to help them have a baby. Ray's family was so liberal and lovely and loving. It was fucking annoying. Lars had recoiled, literally, physically recoiled at the thought. "God, no," he'd said to Ray and his sister. "Just no." He'd felt terrified and suffocated by the thought of all the earnest love he'd have to endure if they had a baby. There would be no escaping it. All those family functions. Ray's mother would never stop crying. It was not happening. Never. Out of nowhere, the mind comes forth. "A Zen koan, give me strength." If Ray really wanted to be a father, should Lars let him go be one with someone else? But wasn't that up to Ray? If Ray couldn't live without children, then he was free to leave. They weren't married. The house was in both their names, but they were both financially secure and sufficiently intelligent people to work all that out. Obviously, Lars could handle a fair division of property. Was it the only way forward? Had their relationship reached an impossible impasse because either way, one of them had to make an impossible sacrifice? Whose sacrifice was worse? But Ray had stopped asking. He'd accepted it. Lars felt that Ray wanted something else from him. What was it? Permission to leave? He didn't want Ray to leave. Something tumbled in the sky. A falling star, for God's sake. How had Marcia managed that? Lars heard everyone exhale with the wonder of it. He closed his eyes, and all of a sudden, it came to him exactly how he knew the big guy on his left, and he wished Ray was here so he could tell him, "I got it, Ray. I got it." Chapter 16. Jessica. The author, Frances Welty, who lay on the yoga mat next to Jessica, was fast asleep. She wasn't snoring, but Jessica could tell she was asleep by the way she breathed. Jessica considered giving her a gentle nudge with her foot. She'd just missed seeing a falling star. On reflection, Jessica decided not to bother her. It was the middle of the night. People her age really needed their sleep. If Jessica's mother had a bad night's sleep, the bags under her eyes made her literally look like something from a horror movie. Though she just laughed when Jessica tried to teach her about concealer. It wasn't necessary to look that bad. It was stupid. If Jessica's dad left her for his PA, Jessica's mother would have no one to blame but herself. Under-eye concealer was invented for a reason. Jessica rolled her head and looked at Ben on the other side of her. He was staring up at the stars with a glazed expression, as if he were considering those Zen riddles, when really he was probably just counting down the hours until he could get out of here and back behind the wheel of his precious car. He turned his head and winked at her. It made her heart lift, as if her crush had winked at her in the classroom. Ben looked back up at the stars, and Jessica touched her face with her fingers. She wondered if her skin looked bad without makeup in the moonlight. There had been no time to put on foundation. They were just dragged from their beds. They could have been having sex when that girl came into their bedroom, with just the gentlest knock on their door and without even waiting for them to say, "Come in," before she marched on in and shone a light in their eyes. They hadn't been having sex. Ben had been asleep, and Jessica had been lying next to him in the darkness, unable to sleep. Missing her phone so badly, it felt like she'd had something amputated. When she couldn't sleep at home, she simply picked up her phone and scrolled through Instagram and Pinterest until she got tired. She looked at her scarlet toenails in the moonlight. If she had her phone with her right now, she would have photographed her feet together with Ben's feet and tagged it hashtag starlight meditation, hashtag health retreat, hashtag learning about koans, hashtag we just saw a falling star, hashtag what is the sound of one hand clapping. That last hashtag would have made her look quite intellectual and spiritual, she thought, which was good, because you had to be careful not to come across as superficial on your socials. She couldn't shake the feeling that if she didn't record this moment on her phone, then it wasn't really happening. It didn't count. It wasn't real life. She knew that was irrational, but she couldn't help it. She literally felt twitchy without her phone. Obviously, she was addicted to it. Still, better than being addicted to heroin. Though these days no one was sure about Ben's sister's most recent drug of choice. She liked to mix it up. Jessica sometimes wondered if all their problems led back to Ben's sister. She was always there, a big black cloud in their blue sky. Because apart from Lucy, honestly, what did they have to worry about? Nothing. They should have been as happy as it was possible to be. Where had they gone wrong? Jessica had been so careful right from day one. What was that stupid thing her mother said? "Oh, Jessica, darling, this sort of thing can ruin people." She said that, all frowny-faced, on what should have been the most spectacular day of Jessica's life. The day that split her life in two. It was 2 years ago now, a Monday evening. Jessica had come home from work in a hurry because she was going to try to make the 6:30 p.m. spin class. She rushed into the tiny kitchen with its ugly laminate bench tops to fill her water bottle. And there was Ben, sitting on the floor, his back up against the dishwasher, his legs splayed, phone held limply in his hand. His face was dead white, his eyes glassy. She got down on the floor next to him, her heart pounding, barely breathing, hardly able to speak. The uppermost thought in her mind was, who? Who? Her first thought was Lucy, of course. Ben's sister flirted with death on a daily basis. But something told her it wasn't Lucy. He seemed too shocked, and Lucy's death was never going to come as a surprise. He said, do you remember how Mum sent us that card? Jessica's heart contracted because she thought it must have been his mother who had died, and she loved Ben's mum. How? She said, how did it happen? How was it possible that Donna had died? She played tennis twice a week. She was healthier and fitter than Jessica. It was probably the stress over Lucy. You remember the card she sent? Ben repeated obliviously, because we were so upset about the robbery. Poor Ben. He was obviously mad with grief, and for some reason he was clutching onto this memory. I remember the card, she said gently. It came in the mail. It had a cute puppy on the front, with a speech bubble coming out of his mouth saying, sorry to hear you're feeling low, and a lottery ticket inside. Donna's message said, you two deserve some good luck. Ben said, the ticket won. Jessica said, what's happened to your mum? Nothing, mum is fine, said Ben. I haven't told her yet. You haven't told her what? Jessica's brain couldn't seem to keep up with the words she was hearing, and she was suddenly angry. Ben, has anybody died or not? Ben smiled. Nobody has died. You're sure? Everybody is in perfect health. Right, she said. Well, good. As the adrenaline left her body, she was suddenly exhausted. She didn't think she could do her spin class now. The ticket won. The ticket that Mum gave us after the robbery. That was the lottery office. We won the first division prize. We just won $22 million. She said tiredly, don't be stupid. We did not. He turned to look at her, and his eyes were red and watery and fearful. He said, we have. If only they'd known in advance, you're gonna win the lottery tomorrow. Then they might have acted like proper lottery winners. But it took a long while for it to feel like a fact. Jessica checked and double-checked the numbers on the internet. She called the lottery office back herself to confirm. It became more real with each phone call they made to their family and friends, and then they finally started doing the screaming and jumping and crying and laughing expected of lottery winners, and invited everyone over to celebrate with the most expensive champagne they could find in the bottle shop. They toasted those pathetic thieves, because if it wasn't for the robbery, they would never have won the lottery.
Ben's mother couldn't get over it. It would never even have crossed my mind to buy you a lottery ticket before. That's the first lottery ticket I've ever bought in my life. I had to ask the lady at the newsagent how it worked. She seemed to want to make sure that no one forgot that she had bought the ticket. She didn't want to share in the prize, although obviously they ended up giving her money. She just wanted everyone to know of her crucial role in this glorious event. It was like a better version of their wedding day. Jessica felt special, the center of attention. She smiled so much, her cheeks ached. The money made her instantly more intelligent and beautiful and stylish. People treated her differently because she was different. When she looked at her own face in the bathroom mirror that night, she could already see it. She glowed with money. Instant wealth was like the best facial ever. But even on that first night, even while Ben and his brothers argued drunkenly over which luxury cars to buy, Jessica could sense Ben's fear growing. "Make sure it doesn't change us," he slurred just before they fell asleep that night. And Jessica thought, "What are you talking about? It's already changed us." Then there was Jessica's mother, who acted as if the win were a catastrophe. "You have to be so careful, Jessica," she said. "This kind of money can send people off the rails." It was true that there had been some unexpected difficulties with this new life, some tricky situations they were still trying to unravel. Friendships they'd lost. One family estrangement. Two family estrangements. No, three. Ben's cousin, who thought they should have paid off his mortgage. They gave him a car. Jessica thought that was generous. Ben liked his cousin, but he barely saw him before the win. In the end, they did pay off his mortgage, but the damage had been done. For God's sake. Jessica's younger sister. They gave her $1 million, but she kept asking for more, more, more. Ben said, "Just give it to her," and they did. But then one day Jessica went out to lunch with her and didn't offer to pay the bill, and now they weren't talking. Jessica's heart clenched as she thought about it. She always paid the bill. Always. It was the one time she didn't, and supposedly that was unforgivable. Ben's stepdad. Because Ben's stepdad was a financial planner, and he'd assumed that he'd manage all their finances now that they had finances. But Ben thought his stepdad was an idiot and didn't want him near their money. So that was awkward. Ben could have kept his opinions about his stepdad a secret forever if it wasn't for winning the lottery. And, of course, Ben's sister. How could they give her money? How could they not give her money? Ben and his mother had agonized over what to do. They tried to do it all the right way, the careful way. They set up a trust fund. They never gave her cash, but cash was all she wanted. When they bought her a car, she sold it within 2 weeks. She sold anything they bought her. She screamed ugly words at poor Ben. "You rich prick with your fancy car, you won't even help out your own family." They spent thousands and thousands on expensive rehab programs that Ben's mother had once dreamed about, assuming those exclusive programs would be the answer, if only they had the money. But once they had the money, they found out that those weren't the answer.
It just went on and on. Ben kept thinking there had to be a solution. Jessica knew there was no solution. Lucy didn't want help. And it wasn't just their family who thought Ben and Jessica should give them money. Every day they were contacted by long-lost relatives and friends of friends asking for loans or a helping hand or wanting Ben and Jessica to support their favourite charity, their local school, their kids' soccer club. Family members they hadn't seen in years got in touch. Family members they didn't know existed got in touch. The requests often had a passive-aggressive edge. $10,000 is probably small change to you, but it would mean a huge amount to us. Just give it to them. That was Ben's constant refrain. But sometimes it got Jessica's back up, the nerve of these people. It was bewildering to Jessica that she and Ben fought more about money now that they had an abundance of it. It was impossible to even imagine they'd once felt so upset about the arrival of unexpected bills. Becoming instantly wealthy was like starting a really stressful, glamorous job for which they had no qualifications or experience. But still, it was a pretty great job. It was hardly something to complain about. There was no need to ruin it, as Ben seemed intent on doing. She sometimes wondered if Ben regretted winning the money. He told her once that he missed working. "Start your own business then," she'd said. "They could do anything." But he said he couldn't compete with Pete, his old boss. He was like his sister. He didn't want a solution to his problems. He said that he didn't like their snooty new neighbours, and Jessica pointed out that they didn't even know them and offered to invite some of them over for drinks, but Ben looked horrified at the idea. It wasn't like they'd really known their neighbours back at the old flat. Everyone had worked full-time and kept to themselves. He enjoyed the luxury holidays they took, but even the travel didn't truly make him happy. Jessica remembered a night watching the sunset in Santorini. It was incredible, gorgeous, and she'd just bought a stunning bracelet for herself, and she'd looked across at Ben, who was deep in what seemed like profound thought, and she said, "What are you thinking about?" "Lucy," he answered. "I remember she used to talk about travelling to the Greek islands." It made her want to scream and scream because they could afford to send Lucy to Santorini and put her up at a great hotel, but that wasn't possible because Lucy preferred to stick needles in her arms. So, fine, let her ruin her own life. But why did she have to ruin their lives as well? The car was the one thing about the lottery win that made him happy. He didn't really care about any of the other things. Not the beautiful house in the best part of Toorak, the concert tickets, the designer labels, the travel. Only the car. His dream car. God, how she hated that car. Jessica realized with a start that people were standing, straightening their unflattering gowns, suppressing yawns. She got to her feet and looked at the starry sky one last time. But there were no answers up there.